Okay, now I think. Hello? Okay. Now I'll set the time on. No, I think they were. Okay. I am so sorry, everyone. I've been having. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, Rabbi.
Hello. Here we are.
Hi, Rabbi Zweiter.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, yes. We can hear
Not
you.
Not very well, but yeah.
I'm so sorry. I'm having like every technical problem possible. Now, you still hear me?
Yes. No, yes, better now.
Okay, I'm really...
okay.
My Wi-Fi is...
Rabbi, I've been having problems logging on.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. Yeah. I was having like every possible technical issue. Okay.
Where's Benjamin when you need him?
What?
Where's Benjamin when you need him?
Yeah, seriously. I don't pay my wife enough to be my IT advisor. But, okay, I'm so sorry. Okay, we're going to start in about 10 seconds. Okay, I'm just bringing my notes up. There we go. Okay. Can you share on this? I don't even know if I can share on this. All right. We're going to do the best we can. Share. I don't know if I can share while I'm using my phone. So we'll do the best we can. Okay. I'm just.
Do you want me to share? I can do that.
Okay. All right. Let's start, and hopefully this will work. Enough apologies. So, just a brief introduction to the series. We're going to do four evenings on modern. Named. Places and times in modern Sephardic history. As you'll see already tonight, that the places and the times, they're critical. We're going to essentially, with at least two, three, maybe even in a way four, but probably three of them, there'll be more of a springboard to a broader discussion of critical issues that that faced Sephardic communities in the modern era. Now, there are two kind of misnomers here, okay? The biggest misnomer is the word Sephardic. The word Sephardic is, I think, probably, I don't know the history of its usage so much, but it is a major misnomer because Sfarad has been historically associated with Spain. The word actually appears in Tanakh. Whether it's referring to Spain is an interesting textual question in terms of biblical interpretation. But historically, the word Sfarad has been used and understood as referring to Spain. Now, we, in modern usage, and this is probably, although again, I don't know the full extent of the history of the usage of the term, but it's probably an Ashkenazi invention that the word Sephardic has been used to basically connote people from all non-Ashkenazi countries, right? So essentially people who came from Jewish communities that were not in Central and Eastern Europe for the most part. So we are using that term because we're going to talk tonight, for instance, about Jews who did originate in the Iberian Peninsula, so Spain and Portugal. So the real bona fide Sfarad. But for instance, next week we'll talk about Iran, which has nothing to do with Sfarad, and they're not Sephardi by any stretch of the imagination. And we're in Iran, the community is much older than the community in Spain. But again, we'll just use the common usage. The second semi-misnomer, we'll put it that way, the semi-misnomer is the word modern. So it's a historical question when studying any field of history is how do you divide the various periods? So what's ancient history? What's classical history? What's medieval? what's early modern, what's modern. So tonight's lecture, so we put it as 1655. Most historians would probably call that the early modern period, and the modern period is probably beginning sometime in the 18th century. But okay, don't hold it against me. Okay, you'll give me a pass on that one, because I do think it's very it's an important event. It's an important discussion, and certainly a very interesting one. So we're going to use 1655 London. Now, here is what our journey is going to take us this evening.
You can share screen.
Okay. Our journey this evening is going to take us actually in London. We're going to start in London in the Middle Ages, and we're going to come back to London almost 400 years later. Okay, and in the interim, we're going to travel to Spain, to Portugal. We're going to travel to the Netherlands. We're even going to travel a little bit to South America, and we'll make our way back to London in 1655. Some you already know this will be a little bit of a spoiler, but the 1655 is when Oliver Cromwell essentially allows the Jews back into England. And that's going to be the end point, okay? So the question is, how do we get there? Okay, so that's really what we're going to discuss tonight. Let's first begin, though, with why aren't there Jews in England, okay? So the history of the Jews in England, we're going to do this in about 30 seconds, okay? The first Jews come to England, we think that the first Jews come to England in the late 11th century, okay, so about the late 11th century, which is during the Norman conquest. Okay, so the first Jews in England are essentially what we would now call, although again, this might be a little bit of an anachronism, they're Ashkenazi Jews, okay, from northern France for the most part. And they come over with the Norman conquest. So they're, in a way, part of the milieu of medieval Ashkenaz of Germany, Germany, France, and somewhat in England. We even have, okay, from Jewish literature point of view, we even have Balei HaTosfos. Okay, so we have commentaries on the Talmud, which were written in by English scholars. Okay, there's actually a volume called Tosfos Chachmei Anglia. Okay, so this is a historic community. But the history is, as I'm sure some also know, is not particularly pleasant all the time. The history of English Jewry is one of virulent anti-Semitism, in fact, blood libels, all kinds of pogroms, although that's also an anachronism, but, I don't have it on here. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. All kinds of anti-Semitic incidents. And, Connie?
Yeah.
Okay, I apologize, everyone. Okay. And finally, in 1290, the Jews are expelled from England. Okay? The Jews are expelled, tragically, from many areas in Europe during the Middle Ages. And in 1290, they are expelled from England. Okay, so for hundreds of years, there's no, and I'm going to use a specific word, there's no official community in England. There are unofficial Jews, there are Jews living there unofficially, okay, even in small groups, but there's no official community allowed in England. Okay, now, let's fast forward from 1290, about 200 years, to 1492. Okay, so we all know what happened in 1492. Put Columbus aside for the time being. Okay, the Jews are expelled from Spain in 1492. 5 years later, they're expelled from Portugal. And as we all know the history, many Jews choose not to leave, and many Jews live as crypto-Jews. They pretend that they're Catholic. However, to one degree or another, okay, and this is a fascinating, fascinating question, exactly how committed these conversos were. There is certainly a spectrum. Okay, to some degree or another, many families and many individuals did live as crypto-Jews and tried to the best of their ability to maintain their Jewish practices and beliefs. amongst those families, okay, and this is where our story really begins. Amongst those families was the family of a somebody who would become known as Rabbi Menashe ben Israel. Okay, so Rabbi Menashe ben Israel wasn't born as Menashe ben Israel. He wasn't, certainly was not born as Rabbi Menashe ben Israel. He's born with the name I'm probably butchering this, Manoel Diaz Soero. Okay, a good, Iberian name. What's actually interesting, parenthetically, is, I don't think this is an example of that, but when you look at the names of crypto Jews from Spain and Portugal, many of them had very Christian names. They purposely, adopted very Christian sounding names. So if you see it, sometimes you'll see something Saint Louisa or something. It's very possible that is a Jewish family or a Jewish person. But in any case, he's born Manoel Diaz Soero in 1604 in Portugal to a crypto Jewish family. Now, in the late 16th century, okay, so in the 1590s, Holland begins freely admitting Jews into its territory, and they settle in various towns and various cities, but Amsterdam becomes this central point of ingathering, if you will, of many Jews, particularly Sephardic Jews, and within that, many crypto Jews who now come to Holland. Holland is now granting grants for the most part, okay, because it's still, early modern Europe, so we'll say for the most part, religious tolerance. And they welcome these Jews, whether full-fledged Jews or crypto Jews, they welcome them into their territory. The family of Menashe ben Israel, this converso or crypto Jewish family, moves to Amsterdam in 1610. Okay, so he's about 5 or 6 years old when the family moves to Amsterdam. He's educated in the yeshivot. He's educated. The Sephardic community already is able to establish academies and yeshivot and schools and synagogues. I'm sure some people here have been to the main synagogue. I think that's older. That comes later, excuse me. But the main Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam. Okay, and they begin to establish this flourishing community. And one of the fascinating parts of the establishment of this community is the fact that these crypto Jews, who some of them for hundreds of years, right, in their families, have lived these semi-quasi-Jewish existence, are now beginning to come out. But you can imagine what that means. Their belief system has been changed, we'll put it that way. Their practices have certainly been changed, okay? And so much of what the Amsterdam Jewish community is dealing with is how do we integrate, reintegrate, or in certain cases not reintegrate many of these crypto-Jewish or these Spanish and Portuguese families that are now trying to come out as and live full-fledged lives. Okay, so this is the community, this is the environment in which Menashe ben Israel grows up. He is, he becomes a rabbi. He becomes one of the preachers and one of the rabbis of the Sephardic community in Amsterdam. And he's I would call, a Renaissance man. He's, he wrote books. We'll talk about them more later. He writes books in Hebrew, in Spanish, and in Latin. Okay, so which is interesting. He's able to write, not just kind of understand, but he's able to write actually in Latin as well. He writes on a plethora of topics, on Jewish law, on Jewish philosophy, on Bible. Okay, I apologize, I keep looking over here, this is where my notes are. In addition to that, into his wide array, if you will, of interests and skills, he also develops this broad network of acquaintances, okay, both Jewish and non-Jewish, so scholars, both Jewish and non-Jewish, politicians, Jewish and non-Jewish, leaders, government officials, within Amsterdam, within Holland, and beyond as well. what Menashe ben Israel, perhaps before the whole episode with England comes up, what he's perhaps most famous for is that he starts the first Hebrew press in Amsterdam. Okay, so not only is he a rabbi and a teacher and all of that, but he's a printer of books. Now, obviously, if you want to publish books, right? So it's good to be a printer of books, right? So it kind of it cuts the process down a little bit, or the red tape. Okay, but he's not just printing his own books, but he does start the first Hebrew press in Holland. So what Menashe ben Israel, though, what happens is, and this is where the story really begins to get very interesting, is that he still has trouble making a living, okay? So he is Jewish communal work, right? I don't know why he couldn't make a living, but and he's a printer, okay? And he's trying to, whatever, you know, make a living off of that, but he's still having trouble. Now, why is he having trouble? Okay, because the other rabbis in Amsterdam, to some degree, although we do see other examples of this, some of them are doing okay. Okay, they're able to make a decent living from their rabbinic work. It seems that Menashe ben Israel, even though he was a rabbi, even though he was considered somewhat of a you know, a Talmid Chacham, a scholar. We'll put it this way. He wasn't considered of the highest rabbinic tier, even in that smaller community of Amsterdam. So he's whatever, let's say second tier. And so he's not getting the prestige and he's not getting the salary that the higher tier are getting. So he needs to make a few more bucks. Okay. So what is he thinking? So we said we're going to travel different parts around the world, okay? We're now in Amsterdam. We're going to take a boat or plane and head over to Brazil for a little bit. What happens? In 1630, the Dutch take over part of Brazil. Again, if I could, I would show it to you on the map. It's just going to be very complicated right now. They take over a region of Brazil called, till this day, Pernambuco, okay, which again, probably not how they pronounce it down there, but Pernambuco, and the most important city in Pernambuco, I believe again, till today, is, anyone know? Recife. Okay, so Recife is a coastal city. It's on the, if you can picture Brazil, again, I would show it to you if I could. If you could picture Brazil in your mind, so it's on that Atlantic coast of Brazil is Recife, and that's where the Jewish community is started, okay? That's where the Jewish community is started. Again, we said that Holland, right, the Dutch take over Pernambuco in 1630. Now, what happens as a result of this? Now, remember, we said a few minutes ago that the Dutch in Holland are offering probably to the greatest degree at that time religious tolerance, okay? So what's happening in Holland itself, right, in the mother country, is that people from all kinds of places and all kinds of religions are gathering in Holland. And to a much smaller degree, but, you know, as somewhat of a microcosm, the same thing is now happening in the Dutch colonies. So it's happening to a degree in Dutch Brazil. Now, who did the Dutch take this over from in 1630? From the Portuguese. Okay, so there were crypto Jews living already in Brazil who had gone over with the Portuguese. Okay, so now that the Dutch take over in 1630, so now the same thing that was happening in Europe is happening now in Dutch Brazil, is that these crypto Jews are now able to come out and begin to live as full-fledged Jews. So there's that element of the Jewish community there in Recife and in Brazil. And in addition to that, there are Jews who hear about the economic prospects in Dutch Brazil, particularly from the sugar trade. Okay, that's where they were making their main, that was their main economic fuel. And so they're coming over to be part of that sugar trade and to be part of that economy. There are Jews coming from Holland itself. They're leaving Amsterdam, they're leaving Holland, and they're coming to be part of this Dutch, Jewish Dutch colony in Brazil. By the way, again, parenthetically, so the first synagogue in the Americas is started and established in Recife. The first rabbi to come to the Americas is in Recife. Okay, so a lot of firsts take place in Recife. Menashe ben Israel is considering going because, again, he figures that economically that'll be more beneficial to him. But he's not yet there, and he's still in Amsterdam. And in the 1640s, somebody comes back from Dutch Brazil and comes to Amsterdam, and he comes with a story. Okay? And the story that this fellow who calls himself Aharon Levi, okay, he calls himself Aharon Levi, but he's known, he comes from a Converso family, and his Converso name, again, you'll excuse me, is Antonio Montezinos, okay? So this Antonio Montezinos, or Aharon Levi, comes to Holland with the following story. He says that I came to Brazil, right? I came to South America. And in South America, I came in contact with a group of what he calls Indians, okay? And they were led by a chief, and he's taken by them into the mountains, which would nowadays be considered Ecuador. Okay, so he's taken by this group of Indians, of native South Americans, into the mountains that we would now call Ecuador. And he hears, right, so this is the story that he's telling the Jewish community, and I guess anyone who wants to listen in Amsterdam, he's telling them the story how when he's on this journey with this group of Native Americans in Ecuador, in South America, he hears one of them talk about God's holy people who live nearby. And there was this group which they called God's holy people who live nearby, and they confess, if you will, that they had mistreated this people for years and years. Okay? But there's this group that, again, this is what he's reporting, that native South Americans call God's holy people. And what happens is that these theories, right? So this Antonio Montezinos has this theory, which he then reports back in Amsterdam, that this God's holy people, and he tells stories about them, how he came across them and he met them, and they had this tradition that they were somehow from the tribe of Reuven, okay, and they were somehow part of the 10 lost tribes that are living in the mountains of Ecuador, okay, so these kinds of myths and these stories that perhaps we've heard circulating around, okay, they're circulating here in the 17th century. And he comes back and he tells the Jewish community in Amsterdam about this. Now, stop there for a moment, okay? So Menashe ben Israel is hearing this, right? So Menashe ben Israel is hearing this. And Menashe ben Israel is hearing this, and in his mind already, now he doesn't say, I believe him right away. Okay, it takes time until Menashe ben Israel comes around, but Menashe ben Israel says, hey, this is really interesting. Okay, this is really interesting that there are people that claim to be part of the lost tribes of Israel. Okay, they claim to be part of the lost tribes of Israel, and they're living in South America. So like I said, stop here for a moment, okay? Messianism, okay, the idea, the concept of messianism in the 17th century is something that is, it's in the air, okay? It's in the air in many different respects. So as many of us know, if we're talking here 1640s, 20 years later, a little over 20 years later, Shabtai Tzvi, quote-unquote, reveals himself, right, and starts this whole tremendous tragedy, really, for worldwide Jewry, okay? And we can trace a lot of the same ideas and the same concepts that brought about Shabtai Tzvi, although that's also for there's a lot of scholarship on that, to some of the same ideas here. And that is already from beginning in 1492, probably a little bit before that even, messianic ideas and messianic feelings are not uncommon amongst in Sephardic communities. Sephardic communities that originated in the Iberian Peninsula in Spain and in Portugal, and then that were expelled in 1492 and in 1497, lived with that trauma. Okay, it was a deeply, deeply traumatic experience for those communities. And as happens, right, as happens very often when people or communities or nations go through traumatic experiences, right? So historically, both within Judaism and without, that tends to raise messianic feelings, messianic ideas quite a bit, right? So you can go back to, for instance...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
What were you referring to was traumatic, because I lost you for a second.
I'm sorry, the expulsion from Spain. Did you get that? Do you hear me? Yes?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Okay, so the expulsion from Spain. Okay, so even though it happened a long time ago, they're living with this idea that the trauma of the wanderings and the sufferings of their communities and their families is somehow a sign that the Messiah is not too far off. That's one aspect within the Jewish world. The very same messianism, not the very same, but similar messianic ideas and feelings are also increasing within particular groups, particular elements of the Christian world as well. So eventually we're gonna end back in London, we're gonna end back in England, right? So what's happening in England at the time? So if you know a little bit of English history, and I know less than a little bit, but what's happening in England at the time is these what's essentially happening all over Europe, right, is these religious wars essentially between Catholics and Protestants and various groups of Protestants. And what's happening is the rise of Puritanism in England at the time. Now, the Puritans were not particularly tolerant people, but as we know from our own American history, right, Puritanism very much drew on Judaism and on, kind of seeing themselves as the historical Israel in many ways, right? We see that a lot from when the Puritans came here. So what's happening in England at the time is, even though they're not religiously tolerant, but a lot of them, to a degree, they still like Jews or they still like Judaism, right? They have this affiliation or these warm feelings for Judaism, particularly because they associate themselves with that. And together with that is that with the rise of Puritanism also comes this Christian messianism. Now, the Christian messianism, right, what's really interesting is that the Christian messianism of that period, okay, also sees the ingathering of all of the tribes of Israel as an essential component to their messianic vision, right? So in their messianic vision, they also view the ingathering of all of the tribes of historical Israel as a central component. Now, in their view, what's going to happen is that that's going to bring about the second coming of Jesus and the eventual conversion of all of Israel and the acceptance of Jesus. Okay, but what you do see, right, is that on the one hand you have this rabbi, this Iberian Portuguese rabbi living in Holland, who's getting reports about lost tribes, and he's part of this environment that has messianic feelings in it. And at the same time, parallel to that, in England, there are people that are getting reports about lost tribes and are also experiencing messianic feelings, right? So what essentially is going to eventually bring the Jews back to England is a shidduch between the the Jewish messianism, if you will, and the Christian messianism. Now, what's tricky and yet, I guess, quote unquote, helpful to each of the sides is that on the one hand, right, what's helpful is that they share many similar components, namely the ingathering of the tribes, okay? What's tricky is what happens after that, right? Okay, so what happens for the Christian messianists is that, well, you ingather the tribes and then, you know, we bring them under our umbrella. What happens to the Jews is obviously not that. Okay. Now, as we said, Menashe doesn't buy into the story all at once, but I won't go into all of the details. There's this correspondence that begins between Menashe ben Israel in Amsterdam and these Christian messianists in England, and letters back and forth, until Menashe really does become convinced that these tribes that were, that these people that are known as God's holy people or whatnot in Ecuador, right, of all places, are in fact some of the lost tribes. Somehow they got to America, okay? And which, by the way, again, parenthetically, during that time period, as Europeans are coming to the Americas, to North and South America, they wonder to themselves, right? This is like the most, you know, pretentious, condescending question that you could ask was, what were they asking themselves? Well, how did people get here, right? They're like, how did people get to this place? And they look so different from us. And they're not part of civilizations. How do they ever get here, right? So all of these questions are related, okay? But in any case, these both these Christian messianists as well as Jewish ones, including Menashe ben Israel, you know, quote unquote, buy into this story that the native South Americans that that they're referring to are in fact from the 10 lost tribes. Now, there's a bit of a controversy as to what happens in the next part of the story. Meaning, how does Menashe begin his bid to get the Jews' permission to resettle in England? So the controversy is essentially revolves around the following question, which the latest literature on this seems to on Menashe ben Israel seems to verify that this is in fact true. That part of Menashe's bid to get the Jews' permission to be allowed back into England related to his messianic idea was that Menashe had this idea that in order for the Jews, in order for the Mashiach, right, in order for the Jewish Messiah to come and the final redemption to come about, the Jews needed to be scattered all over the world, right? So he read through the Bible, he read through parts of Tanakh, and the way he understood them was that God is going to gather the Jewish people from all corners of the earth. So he said to himself, well, it's clear that the redemption can't come unless we are actually in all four corners of the earth. So if we're not in all four corners of the earth, right, God can't gather us from all four of those corners, and so therefore we have to make sure what that we are in fact scattered. It's like the circular, almost logic, but the circular idea. So he said to himself, "Well, there are places where there aren't Jews, and so that's preventing, that's impeding the final redemption." And so he said to himself, "One of those places is what is England," because he said, "I know that in 1290." The Jews were expelled. The Jews were expelled from England. So I now have to make sure that Jews are able to resettle in England, so that essentially they can be taken out of England along with being taken out of all of the other lands and all of the other countries. Okay, so that's one major factor in terms of his motivation for trying to get the Jews permission to resettle back in England. Right, a lot of the questions that that scholars ask revolving around this whole episode is, well, what were the main factors that motivated him? Right, what were the main factors that motivated him in his quest to get permission for the Jews to move back to England? Right, So one of them clearly is what we've been talking about until now, which is this messianic idea, which has England somehow plays this role in it for Menashe ben Israel. And it's based, right, so all of this kind of stems from these reports that he's getting of the 10 lost tribes, which awaken this messianic idea. And the messianic idea then brings him to the next step of trying to make sure that there are Jews in England so that we are, in fact, scattered all over the world. So Menashe ben Israel writes one of his most famous works, which is called Mikveh Israel. It has nothing to do with the ritual bath, okay? Mikveh, it means hope, also like the word tikvah, okay? It was translated into English as hope of Israel, but it's originally written in Latin, actually. And it's in Hebrew, it's called Mikveh Israel. In English, Hope of Israel. And there he talks about these lost tribes. Okay, there he talks about the lost tribes and how the lost tribes are a sign about the impending a messianic era and the ingathering of the Jewish exiles. Okay, so again, one of the main factors in Menashe's, in terms of his motivation, is certainly the messianism. Now, let's take a break from messianism for a moment, travel back to Brazil, and see what's going on there. The Dutch remain in Brazil not for a relatively short time. In, I think it falls in 1654. I forget the exact year when the Portuguese come back to Brazil. But the Portuguese come back to Brazil and want to conquer, they want to reconquer or retake the colonies which they had lost to the Dutch in 1630. Again, this is a very, very valuable, the very valuable sugar trade, okay? So the Portuguese lay siege to Dutch Brazil, and Dutch Brazil finally falls to the Portuguese in 1654. Now, as American Jews, that's a big year, right? In 1654, as a result of the fall of Dutch Brazil and Recife, so those 23 Jews, for some reason we don't really know why, but make their way to Manhattan Island and become the first Jews in what becomes the United States later on. Okay, so that's why we know the year 1654. But 1654. Is when Dutch Brazil fell back to the Portuguese. The Jews couldn't stay because with the Portuguese comes what? Comes the Inquisition, right? So they can't live freely as Jews, and they don't want to, okay? So now what do most of these Jews do? So we just said 23 of them somehow, there are all kinds of theories as to why, but they make their way all the way north to Manhattan. Okay, we'll put those aside for the moment. A number of them, not so many, but a number of them settle in the Dutch colonies in the Caribbean, okay, in the various Dutch colonies in the Caribbean. But most of them decide to go back to Holland, okay, and particularly to Amsterdam. Now, what happens? There are approximately 1,000 of them, we think. We think there are approximately 1,000 of them trying to come back to Amsterdam. The problem with that is that the Jewish community can't support another 1,000 Jews moving in at once, right? Maybe gradually, but not at once. So number one is that there's simply no room for them, okay? So there's simply no room in the Jewish quarter in where the Jewish community lived for them to settle. So that's one problem. Another problem is an economic problem, is that the guilds in Holland have kind of quotas, right, as to how many, right? We said before, they're probably the most tolerant at that time period, but, right, that's all a relative term, okay? So the guilds only have certain numbers of Jews which they allow to join. So that's another problem, that they can't take all these Jews in, absorb all these Jews at once. Those are all communal problems. There's a personal problem for Menashe ben Israel as well, right? So all of those affect him, but there's a more personal problem as well. And the personal problem is that returning with those 1,000 Jews is the rabbi who had went with them to Brazil and is now returning back to Amsterdam. Now, if you remember, right, Menashe, we said, is, okay, he's, let's say, a scholar, but he's, you know, he's considered about, you know, I don't know, AAA, right? He's not quite in the major leagues, okay? He's a second-tier rabbi there in the Sfarik community of Amsterdam. And so he now has a problem with Rabbi Yitzchak Abohav, was his name, returning back to Amsterdam. Menashe now looks west towards where, northwest, right, towards England and says, hey, right, so he's already thinking about England. It's already in his mind because of these messianic ideas, but he looks there and says, hey, this is also going to work for us, right, economically. This is going to work for us, and this may work for me as well. Okay, so he says, this is a place where I can go and be a rabbi. This is a place where these Jews who are now returning can also go as well. So like we said before, there are various components to the return of the Jews to England. And the question that scholars, you know, struggle with is, well, which is the most critical? Which is the most critical? Now, some people over the years have tried to downplay Menashe ben Israel's messianism to a degree, okay, particularly, excuse me, as it pertains to England. But again, the latest literature, there was a book, by the way, which I recommend. I don't get a cut, but I do recommend it. There's a biography of Menashe ben Israel. There's this great series put out by Yale University. I think it's Yale University Press. It's called the Jewish Lives series. They have an enormous number of books. They've been, I don't know, publishing them the last 10, 15 years, I think. From like Moshe to Menashe ben Israel and Harry Houdini. Really, I mean, like quite the range. So that in about a couple of years ago, they put out a biography of Menashe ben Israel, Menashe ben Israel, Rabbi of Amsterdam. Really a great book. So in any case, the latest literature seems to indicate that Menashe, that the messianism did play a very central role. It wasn't, you know, secondary. It wasn't just an ancillary role, but it really was critical and central to Menashe's thinking. But again, all of these factors, the economic factor, the religious factor, all of these, the personal, you know, ambitions, all of these play a role in terms of his wanting to bring the Jews back to England. So what's happening in England at the time? Okay, so Menashe begins these petitions, or these letters, I should say, towards England, to England, to London. And again, England is in the midst of decades of religious wars. And at the time, the ruler of England is, again, we're not going to go through the specifics of the English history here, but the ruler of England is Oliver Cromwell, okay? And Oliver Cromwell is a Puritan, okay? So he adopts Puritanism. He eventually is the one that gives permission for the Jews to resettle in England. Now, again, much as we just said, there's a question within historical scholarship as to what Rabbi Menashe ben Israel's motivations were. There's just as much a question as to what were Cromwell's motivations for allowing, you know, Jews who had been at least officially not allowed to live in England since 1290. So you're talking, 350 years or so, 360 years. Why all of a sudden does he want them to? So again, there are various factors and there are various theories as to which one of those factors is the most compelling and is the most important one. But on the one hand, it's possible that he was bitten at least to a degree by some sort of messianic. He was convinced by some sort of messianic idea, right? There's this, again, as intolerant as the Puritans were, really most people were back then, right? But as intolerant as the Puritans were back then, there was this kind of latent, what we would call like a philo-Semitism, right? This affiliation or this, I won't say love, but even though the word philo means love, right? But this positive feeling towards Judaism and maybe towards Jews. But at the same time, okay, so Cromwell believed to a degree, right? So it's interesting. Cromwell agreed to a degree, even though he was Puritan and very adamant and strong in his Puritan beliefs, he did believe to a degree in tolerance, but more for political reasons, right? He thought that that would strengthen his control and his rule. Right? Only non-Catholics, okay? Catholics were beyond the pale for them. So even Jews were part of that tolerant sense, which Cromwell believed would strengthen if he allowed these people in and kind of, you know, if I'm nice to you, you'll be nice to me. If I scratch your back, you'll scratch my back, right? And so he believed that that would strengthen his rule. And as very often is the case in Jewish history, probably more often than not, is when countries and rulers allowed Jews in, it was very often for economic reasons, where they thought that the Jews would be able to benefit them economically. And this was very important. This actually, during this time period, was very critical in terms of the Jews' acceptance in various places, is that, right, remember, the Sephardic Jews are expelled from Spain in 1492, Portugal 1497. They then disperse all over, right? So all over the Ottoman Empire, North Africa, the Middle East, Southern Europe, right, Holland later on, etc., right? So they have this vast network, right? There's a vast network of Sephardic Jews with both family connections, communal connections, all kinds of connections, and that really worked to the Jews' benefit, and right, they weren't the only ones that saw that, okay? So others also saw that, the rulers and governors of these various places saw that, including possibly Oliver Cromwell, and said, well, this is going to benefit my economy, and this is going to benefit essentially my rule. So what happens is, it's interesting, is that 1655 is when Menashe ben Israel himself comes to London. Okay, he finally gets to London. Sadly, he dies 2 years later in 1657, and his body is brought back to Holland. He's buried there. So he doesn't get to you know, see, if you will, the fruits of his labor much. But in 1655, the Jews are, in a way, unofficially allowed back into Holland, meaning Cromwell says, okay, but there's no legislation or so that allows them to do so. And the debate about whether to allow the Jews to remain continues for years and years after that. Into the 1680s, the English are debating whether or not to allow the Jews to remain. Okay, so they're kind of given like a wink in 1655 and said, okay, you can be here, but there's no stamp on it. But that is the beginning, if you will, of the modern British community. Okay, so what happens, and we'll end with this, is again, 1655, Menashe comes to, finally makes it himself to London. That's when the Jews are given, again, unofficial, but albeit permission to remain. In 1657, the first synagogue is established in London. In 1701, just giving a couple landmarks here. In 1701, the famous Bevis Marks Synagogue is founded. Okay, that's the I think it's the oldest standing synagogue, something of that nature in Europe, or maybe in the world, something like that in Europe, I think, or certainly in England. In 1701, still there actually. The rabbi's a friend of mine. The Bevis Marks Synagogue is founded in 1701. The Jews are not fully emancipated in England until 1858. Okay, so until 1858, the Jews are tolerated. They're prosperous in many ways, but they're not fully emancipated until 1858. And just in terms of the makeup of the community and how this really follows from this whole story, right, of the Sephardic Jews, is that the community, up until the late 19th century, so until about the 1880s or so, in 1882, I believe, the community in England numbers approximately 40,000, the vast majority of which are Sephardic still, okay, approximately 40,000. Beginning in the 1880s, the numbers balloon because of immigration from Eastern Europe, much like happens to the United States. So a number of them go to England as well. And that's you know, basically the makeup of the current community. So again, just we'll end here, but, you know, the story of Menashe ben Israel, even though it has all these, like, almost crazy, like mystical and really far out ideas and elements to it about the messianism and the lost tribes and all of this, and the characters that are involved in the Christian messianists and all of that. But it really does reflect, and this is the reason I chose it as one of the classes, is that it really does reflect to a degree this this experience of the Sephardic communities coming out of, even though it wasn't immediately after, but coming out of the expulsion and that identity as Sephardic Jews and the idea and the goal, if you will, and the objective of being accepted. So they're accepted in Amsterdam and trying to be accepted in other places, in this case in England. And so it really is reflective of the experience of these communities in terms of their quest for acceptance, because of their history as one of lack of acceptance, you know, certainly from the expulsion, and now it's one of seeking acceptance in various countries and under various rulers. Okay, next week we'll talk about a topic of complete lack of acceptance, okay, and we'll go, as we said, to way east, to Iran, to Mashhad, and we'll talk about the experience of the tragic experience of the Jews there. Okay, so thank you all again. I apologize for the technical problems, but hopefully that it worked okay in the end.
Thank you very
much. All right,
much.
Have a good evening, Laila Tov.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Rabbi.